Today's program is proudly brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Visit WholeFoodsMarket.com or download the Whole Foods Market app to learn more and find the store nearest to you.
Food and travel. They go hand in hand. And chances are, if you're a fan of Heritage Radio Network, you love them both. Between April 10th and 24th, we have six incredible food and travel experiences up for auction at CharityBuzz.com. Go on an underground food tour of New Orleans with a rocket scientist. Get your hands on VIP passes to Feast Portland, or enjoy a ranch-to-table experience in wine country. Four of the experiences include hotel stays at some of the most iconic properties across the country, including the newly reopened Hotel Claremont in Atlanta. Now's your chance to win the ultimate bourbon and beyond weekend in Lexington, or take in a Latin food tour of New York's outer boroughs. You'll eat, drink, explore, and relax, all while supporting Heritage Radio Network. Help us keep the lights on and the mics hot. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/auction and bid now.
I'm Massimo Bottura.
Hi, this is Amanda Cohen.
This is David Kinch.
This is Mike Anthony.
This is Huni Kim.
This is Amanda Freitag.
This is Richard Blaze.
This is Paul Kahn.
This is Curtis Stein.
This is Stephen Harris.
This is Missy Robbins.
And you're listening to Andrew Talks to Chefs on Heritage Radio.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. This is Andrew Talks to Chefs. I am your host, Andrew Friedman, and I am talking in a low voice because it is 5 a.m. I am in a hotel room in the Napa Valley, and I don't want to wake up the people in the neighboring rooms as I do my intro. So that is why I sound conspiratorial. I'm also alone, and I've been on the road for close to a week, but I need to record an intro for this week's show. So here I am. This is one of the rare moments where I'm thankful that my body is still on East Coast time because I woke up early enough to send this in to Dave so that he can put it together. Our guest this week is one of the iconic chefs of his generation, Norman Van Aken. I'm just going to say of the state of Florida because he has operated in so many places down there, dating back to when he first showed up there as a young man in Key West. He used to have a restaurant in Coral Gables, which is my hometown. Don't usually acknowledge that, but it is. And I'm going to introduce Norman properly in just a moment, but I want to set the stage for you guys. It is, as I said, early in the morning. I haven't even peered outside to see if the sun's up. I am at the El Bonita Motel on Highway 29 in St. Helena. I am here for the Worlds of Flavor Conference, which is put on by the Culinary Institute of America. I will be introducing people. I will be moderating a panel. I will be participating in a panel on Friday. And that's why I'm here. I have been on the road since last Thursday, almost a week now. And I have to say, absolutely more than ever in love with this industry that I find myself in. And I'm going to just quickly tell you guys where I've been because I think it's kind of interesting. First of all, because this is what a writer who isn't super famous, super well-funded, has to do in the year 2018 to promote a book. I largely myself put together a book tour. Publishers these days do not have the budgets they used to. I've been very proudly talking about my book tour on social media and a little bit on this show. And it is a book tour, but it is a book tour largely of my design. And it's largely come together through the generosity of friends, through the time of new friends I've made, many of those people friends I made through writing my book. I started off in Los Angeles. I spoke on Saturday to the culinary historians of Southern California, who took me to lunch at Little Sister, a Vietnamese restaurant in downtown LA afterwards. Those were both great experiences for me. Saturday night, I was at Now Serving, which is a relatively new culinary shop, mostly a bookshop, but they do have some knives and things like that. It is in Chinatown in Los Angeles. Amazing turnout to a little bookstore in Chinatown on a Saturday night at 7 p.m. It was an amazing crowd. And Russ Parsons, the former LA Times food editor and columnist, came out on a Saturday to interview me, which was amazing. Master Wine, the company owned by Mel and Janie Master, who were Jonathan Waxman's partners in Jam's restaurant and other restaurants back in the 80s, donated wine to that event. These are all people I met on the road while interviewing them for my book, and they've all been just amazing. I then, on Sunday, got on a plane and came to San Francisco. I was at the San Francisco Cooking School at the invitation of the founder, Jody Liano, who I already adore. Jody's just the most warm, organized, professional person. And we together put together a panel of chefs. We had Larry Forgione, Ken Frank, Joyce Goldstein, Jesse Cool, Tracy Desjardins, and Lawrence Jossel, who has the restaurant Nopa here, was kind enough to moderate the panel. And then he had us all over to dinner at Nopa. John Birdsall, a fellow writer, I think probably pound for pound, as good a writer as there is about this industry, today showed up, was in the audience. I will say it was at my invitation, and I was delighted that he was there. Jim Dodge, who years ago was the pastry chef at the Stanford Court Hotel in San Francisco. He now runs special culinary culinary programs for the Bon Appetit Management Company. Jim invited me to do signings at some of their accounts. And those are no small accounts. I was taken by Jim on Monday to the offices of Twitter, the mothership of Twitter. They did a lunchtime giveaway of 80 of my books, and we had a signing. It was amazing. People were lined up. They were so enthusiastic and just great. And then we went to the offices of SAP in Palo Alto on Tuesday. I was at Omnivore Books Monday night, the beloved bookstore, culinary bookstore here in, or not here anymore, I'm already in Napa, but in San Francisco. And Celia is someone I got to know when I was researching my book and would pop into her store. And she was kind enough to host me. And then last night, right before I drove to Napa, kind of halfway up here, I stopped in Larkspur, California, and I did an event at the beautiful Diesel bookstore. There's also a Diesel bookstore in Brentwood. And David Kinch was kind enough to make a two-hour drive from Los Gatos, where Manresa is, up to Larkspur to be, as they say at these book events these days, in conversation with me. And then we did our thing, and he turned around and went and met some people in the city for dinner, and I came north to Napa. And I probably should have gone right to bed, but I knew that some people were hanging out here in town, and I went and met them and had a drink or two. And I'm tired, as you probably tell by my slight stumbling through this interview. But I'm not hungover. I'm just a little sleepy. But I have to say, most of those people I just named were people I met on the research trail. They're all colleagues. It's probably pretty evenly split between fellow writers and people in the chef and restaurant community. And one of the reasons I was able to do this trip at all is that Anne McBride, who's another newish friend of mine, who organizes the Worlds of Flavor Conference here at the CIA in St. Helena, invited me to be a speaker this year. And they provide travel. And that got me to the West Coast. And I was able to sort of build this week of amazing activity around that invitation. So that's what the life of a writer is like in 2018. I have to say, I'm thankful to have the stamina to still be able to run around like this. And it's just been amazing. It's just been the most incredible week. And I've also had some great meals. I had dinner at Maud in LA, or Beverly Hills, I should say. I had dinner at Otium in downtown Los Angeles. That's Tim Hollingsworth's restaurant. Maud, of course, the chef is Justin Hilbert, and it's chef owner Curtis Stone's restaurant. I had drinks atop the Waldorf Astoria in Beverly Hills. It's a the rooftop by John George up there, John George von Richten's place. It is one of the most spectacular views you will ever see of any city. You guys should go up there if you're in town or if you live there. I also have to say there were listeners on the road. There were a ton of listeners out there. Most recently last night, I met Melanie and Nate in Larkspur. They just recently moved out here from New York City. Anyway, that is what the last week has been. Kind of an amazing experience. The interview today is with Norman Van Aken. As I say, he is a Florida icon. He's been cooking down there since the 80s. He's had restaurants in various cities. And he is someone also who I got to know when I went made a trip down there to interview him for my book. And he was kind enough to suggest that we spend 2 days together sort of co-promoting each other. He has a recent book called Norman Van Aken's Florida Kitchen. It is his sixth cookbook. He's also written an amazing memoir just a few years ago called No Experience Necessary, which is a great title. It refers to how his first kitchen job was described in the ad promoting it. I highly recommend it. Norman writes himself. He doesn't use a collaborator, and he's really great at it. He is also, I should say, just a universally adored guy in the industry. Just a big, warm-hearted guy. He is constantly in the company of his wife, Janet, who is also just an incredibly warm, generous person. And we spent, the three of us really, although Norman and I were the only two getting up on stage, but we spent 2 days together. We did a book event at his new cooking school, In the Kitchen with Norman Van Aken, which is in downtown Miami. I was privileged enough to have dinner at Three, his new restaurant in downtown Miami. And we spoke together at Books and Books, which is a legendary bookstore chain now, although we were right near the original Coral Gables location, which is biking distance from where I grew up. And we met at Palacio de los Jugos, which translates literally as the Palace of the Juices. I like to refer to it as the Juice Palace. I think that is a cooler way to refer to it. But it's an amazing place. It's they have open air seating outside, and inside they have there's like a little market area. There's as the name would suggest, tons of fresh pressed juices. Many of them packed up into I guess 1/2-gallon containers and for purchase. Mostly what we would call tropical flavors, and then they have all these hotlines where you can get sort of cafeteria style food. And that's what we did. The three of us had lunch there. I had a braised lamb shank with rice and beans and a half an avocado. And I rarely drink a Coke anymore, but I have to have a Coca-Cola when I'm sitting in the hot sun eating that food. It's just Pavlovian for me. Anyway, we sat down and we talked a little about Norman's career, a little about cooking, a little about writing. And I also have to just quickly mention, we allude during our interview to the Bruce Martyr episode of this show, and that is indeed episode 24 for anyone who wants to look it up. I wasn't sure during the interview. And I should also say, please be sure to listen, especially if you are in the New York area, to the break today. Right when we come back from break, there's sort of a mini interview about something that's going on in New York City. That I'd love for you guys to hear. It's with Chef Dan Kluger of Loring Place, who was on the show earlier this season. And with that, I'm going to get you to our interview with Chef Norman Van Aken, recorded just a few weeks ago at Palacio de los Jugos in Coral Gables, Florida. I hope you enjoy it.
Because this is one of the places that made me fall in love with Miami. This is Palacio de los Jugos, which translates as the Palace of Juices.
Mm-hmm.
And it's much more than juices, as you can see from being here. But that's the way it began, as a little juice stand that has metamorphosed, has become this big thing that it is, which is everything. It's a cafeteria, it's a fruit stand, you can get fabulous juices things to take home. There's a whole fish section. There's a Cuban sandwich station with all other kinds of sandwiches as well.
Yep.
I was brought here by a guy in 1992 who owned the hotel where I had come to be the chef of. I had come out of Key West with Janet, shot up to Boca to do a job, and that was not my scene. So I got a job offer in the rebuilding period of time at Miami Beach.
Yeah.
On Ocean Drive. And this gentleman, who was one of the most memorable characters I've ever known in my life, owned the Betsy Ross Hotel. His name was Novell. Novell was very proud of his success as a sort of a remade man coming from Cuba, coming to the United States during the 60s and the tumultuous time, coming into Freedom Tower and being processed there and actually being shipped up to New York. But he came back to Miami, like many, brought me to this place, Palacio.
To this location?
This location.
Wow.
This is the original one.
Okay.
There's others in town.
There's about five now,
five
I
or
think?
Six.
Yeah.
And I was just like in Wonderland, walking around and seeing the extraordinary fruits and vegetables, tubers, primarily fruits and tubers that were kept on the outdoor racks. Here at Palacios, they understand the fruit of the tropics in that it's not refrigerated. The fruit of the tropics, you know, would like to be as refrigerated as much as a parakeet or a cat would like to be refrigerated. Not.
And we should say, as listeners may or may not know, I may have said it in the introduction, which I tape after these interviews, I grew up actually a few miles from where we're sitting.
Mm-hmm.
And to say something doesn't want to be refrigerated in Miami is a much different statement than it is in New York, where I now live, or in the Midwest, where you grew up. Mm-hmm. That is a bold statement for a perishable product.
Yeah, but it taught me something as a chef, too, which was that I started to put things in our kitchens called ripening racks. And I mean, people understand that for tomatoes, and they understand that tomatoes just cannot be in the refrigerator. But for the plantains and for the mangoes and the guanabana and the other things that began to filter into my menus, we would properly ripen them on newspapers until the moment we were going to use them.
Yeah.
So this is, you know, this is a place that people come, families come. There's oftentimes musicians that are here. There's sometimes trucks that pull up and they sell everything from cowboy hats to shrimp from the Keys.
Yeah.
It's
amazing.
Street market.
Now, I strangely, for a writer, have a very bad memory for setting.
Mm.
It's a weakness of mine.
Mm.
So while we're sitting here, I'm just going to say, Norma just did a very good job of describing what goes on inside. This is what I would call almost a half open air situation. It's basically tented with sort of a yellow and red striped covering. And adjacent to the area that he described that has all these, what to a lot of people would look like something almost like you'd see at, well, these food stalls that are popping up or a Coney Island or inside where the food mart where you can go up to these windows and get the food.
It's a little bit of a circus kind of a tent look crossed with an inexpensive car lot.
Yeah. And we are sitting, the parking lot wraps around this communal seating area. We're sitting at these metallic tables with metallic benches. This is, I think, probably very wise material selection in the tropics, right? It's hot, it's humid. This stuff is built to last in this environment.
Absolutely.
And it's a scene, and you can hear, if you can make out any of the voices in the background, it is a panoply of Latin American accents.
And it's still a place that you'd be much better off knowing some workable Spanish to come to, because they are friendly as can be, but they do not...
The people I ordered my lunch from did not speak English.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, fortunately, I grew up here, so...
But I oftentimes...
Hablo español.
That's pretty good. I asked a lady that was standing next to me, and she cheerfully translated everything that was in front of me.
Oh,
even
nice.
Though, I mean, I could see what it was, but I didn't know the names until she told me more particularly what they were. And it's delicious. I mean, the portions are massive, and the flavors are traditional.
Yeah. So, Norman, you just spoke about this place and the ingredients here. And, you've had this multi-decade love affair with the food of this region, with the ingredients of this region. How do you, this may seem like an odd question, but how do you relate to those things? What is it about those particular things coming from the Midwest, which is about as different as you can get from where we are right now. Put aside for a minute Key West, which I know you loved as well, and the environment. What is it about the food that you connected with? And I almost feel like you connected with it. Your wife, Janet, sitting here. I almost feel like you connected with the food the way you might connect with a person. I feel like this was like a love at first sight thing for you. Your eyes just widened when I said that.
Because I say that sometimes. You know, I fell in love first with Key West like you fall in love with a woman or another person. It was not just a place. It was something deeper, and it was more like an intuitive form of recognition.
Yeah.
But coming back to the fruits and the vegetables and the tubers that were here, fortunately for me, growing up in the Midwest, even though we don't have a 12-month growing season like in the American South, we did have our beautiful summers. And my mom would often take us to a farm stand called Big John's, which wasn't big at all, really. But there was something about it that just, you know, it was just like, I don't know, even as a little kid, when I was 6 and 7 years old, getting tomatoes or peas or cold sweet corn from Big John's, going home, setting up a grill or cooking inside if it was, you know, because this was summertime. You know, this was not when you would... You wouldn't be out there in the snow at Big John's because they were closed for probably 8 months out of the year. But it was the celebration of the seasonality of Big John's that probably was the early spark. And then coming here and seeing this, sort of like in my mind, it was reminiscent of watching when The Wizard of Oz switches from black and white to color.
Yeah. I love that analogy. So how over the years has your... How do you stay? Are you still curious? Is there still a curiosity level for you about this type of food, about like the stuff that's inside the doors here from where we're sitting? Or do you feel like you've kind of earned your de facto PhD and, you know, you're now the you would never use this word, but you're like the master now, or you're there to teach other people now? Do you still learn new things about this stuff?
Absolutely.
How?
It's just so... You know, it's a motherly cuisine, and that's just so generous in its spirit. And I love that, you know, and I don't believe that you elevate cuisine when you become a chef and you go, well, I've taken this, you know, native food. Now I'm going to, you know, do some arbitrary things to it and it's going to become better. I don't believe that. I think that's a mistake and probably more of a male mentality than a female mentality.
I totally agree with that, yeah.
But that being said, I mean, because of the repertoire that I have from being in kitchens and in life and travel and all of that for the last 45 years, there are times that I will have things in my mind that I will say, instead of using just a squeeze of orange, I might want to use some great vinegar or something like that. So it's just not really of me a matter of fixing something up. It's just a matter of me maybe, you know, being the engineer for a moment. You know, the musical thing here comes again, but there are people who write and play music and sing well, and then there are people who can engineer, which can do some things which create a different sort of drama.
Yeah.
And so my job, I think, is in some respect, is to continually be willing to translate things to provide slightly different dramas, you know?
Right. So you and I, we're in the middle of a two-day kind of... What do we call it? Like a co-promotional couple of days. We did a NPR interview yesterday. We had an event at your new cooking school, which I want to talk about before we're done. We're doing an event at a bookstore tonight here in Miami at Books and Books. Thank you, Books and Books.
Love that place.
But, you know, one of the things that's already come up in multiple interviews, part of it's because of your memoir and the book that I've been promoting, is this question of, you know, kids today. You know, these young cooks today, right? And what do you think of these young cooks today? Putting aside any observations about them, I'm going to throw out an observation about your generation of chef, and I'd love to just get your thoughts on it. A lot of people who started cooking when you did would now, today, this term didn't exist, be considered what we call career changers. In some cases, and I think maybe you would apply this to yourself, you had a lot of jobs, but you didn't really have another career until you found this one.
Absolutely not.
Right. So, but because I've always thought that in many ways it was a huge plus for people who came up cooking when you did, when you grew up not knowing that's what you were going to do, a lot of people of your generation are very, what, to use an overused term, well-rounded. You know, you're an avid reader. People had interest in the arts. You know, someone like Alfred Portale was a jewelry designer. You just said, and music. Do you feel like coming to cooking a little bit later than people do today, with these other things going on in your psyche and in your head and your heart, do you feel like that stuff flowed into your cooking? Do you feel like those things helped shape you as a chef in a way that maybe someone who was more turned on to cooking at a super young age and was more one track might be missing?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of pressure on the people who begin cooking now and don't have the life experiences to have roamed around a little bit in their minds, if not in their lives, and seen some other things, seen people from other walks of life and in other countries, or even through art or books or music. You know, they get out of whatever high school and tunnel straight into this mindset that they're gonna, you know, live a life and be like my dear friend Charlie Trotter or Thomas Keller, and forego this period of time that is so fundamentally important, of this time of slowly becoming who they are. You know, and I've talked to my teams about this. You know, I sat them down, I drew out a graph to say, listen, I want you to understand some things. You know, how old are you and how old are you? And the average age was, let's say, 28 or 29 years old.
Yeah.
I'll say, listen, let me tell you something. By the time I was 28 or 29, I had never been in a magazine.
Right.
I have never owned a restaurant. I had never written a cookbook. I had not been on the stage making a presentation.
Yeah.
I had not even known how to make some of the basic sauces that you know how to make at your age. How did that happen? You know, my point of acceleration came when it was right for me. Your point of acceleration will be when it comes right for you. There's an Epictetus quote in here somewhere, I'm sure. But it has to do with, you know, things being right and ripe within their time. You cannot hurry them along. If you do, it'll be like, you know, picking that avocado off the tree 6 months before it should have been, and it will never ripen to what it could become. So I fear for them a little bit, you know, that they won't have enough life's experience. They crack up, my teams, when they do find out that through my memoir that, you know, I worked in a carnival or I was a hot tar roofer or I did these other things, selling flowers in Honolulu and factory worker and, you know, this life before and hitchhiking back and forth and, you know, Janet and I running off to here and there. And I think they kind of like feel like, oh, I can't do that. That's not for me. That was a different generation. Maybe, maybe not. I don't know.
Yeah.
But I think Bruce Marder said something, and I'd love to know him better, about it. He doesn't think that anybody gets to do what we're doing now with food without already having something analogous through the arts or through design of some
sort. Architecture, design.
Architecture.
You're referring to the interview he and I did on this series.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think for people listening, that's episode 24. I will check it and say it in the mid-show break. But I think that if you want to listen to Bruce's conversation about that, yeah, it is interesting. Well, I've known chefs who I remember years ago Marcus Samuelson telling me he used to go to, you know, the museums of Midtown and Uptown New York City because it would affect, he'd get ideas for food. Now, obviously, that's not literal. There's not a literal connection between those things, but he was stimulated, I guess is the word I would use,
absolutely,
by that kind of stuff.
I would buy French cookbooks, not speaking or reading a word of French, to flip through the pages and just go, I don't know what this exactly means, but it's inspiring me to create these logs that I call dream sheets, just flipping through those things.
Yeah.
Whether it was that or whether it was, you know, perceiving the beauty or power of the songs and music and try to find something. Essentially, you know, to me, it's not about making food. It's about making memories anyway.
Right.
And so I want to go to some place in my mind, my heart, where I am going to be able to create memories. And it's tough because our performance
is one of the most consumed things that possibly could be. So there's nothing left. And Charlie and I spoke about this a lot. Like, I mean, you could be, you know, you could be a member of the band with Bob Dylan and, you know, you could write an album, do an album, Big Pink, and that would be around for years. I just actually played Side A this morning.
Uh-huh.
And yet what we do is gone by midnight. You know, it's gone. It's all it can be is a memory.
Yeah.
And so that's a little bit of a challenge, but if that's all it can be, make the most that it can be.
But doesn't that also, in a strange way, make it even more, I don't want to compare things, but in a way to me, that makes it, I've thought a lot about that when I was writing this book, and I have some thoughts about, similar thoughts to what you just said in this book, but to me, that can be a little bit wistful and sad, but it also, to me, makes the moment of creating that on your part, enjoying that on the part of the diner, all the more special, right? I mean, it's
yes.
something that can
yes.
only ever exist yeah. in that moment between you, your team, and the people eating your food.
You have to embrace the zen of this.
Exactly.
It's as evanescent as anything that you could do.
Embrace the zen of it, right.
Embrace the zen.
I mean,
somebody once said, you know, you guys are like sculptors, but you're like sculpting in snow. And I said, that's not so. We're sculptors who sculpt in rain.
We're sculptors who sculpt in snow on a 90-degree Florida afternoon. Yeah.
Right.
Exactly. Yeah. It's amazing. So look, can we talk for a minute about this thing you and I both do? I've never been a chef or even a professional cook. We both write. You write your own books.
Mm-hmm.
I think I've told you this. So I'll say it on the air. I think your books are amazing. I think you're an amazing writer. First of all, I'm always amazed by chefs who are able to write, because I think very often the chef temperament is incompatible. This will sound like a joke. You'll know I mean it seriously. But for listeners, I'm not joking. I feel like it's very often incompatible with one of the main necessities of writing, which is sitting in a chair for hours mm-hmm. on end
mm-hmm.
and focusing and writing prose. For mm-hmm. many people who mm-hmm. find a life in the kitchen,
mm-hmm.
that's just metabolically not something they're mm-hmm. capable or interested in doing. Mm-hmm. So I'm mm-hmm. always amazed when somebody's brain can both be a chef and be a writer.
Mm-hmm.
But beyond that, with someone as busy as you are, perennially mm-hmm. busy,
mm-hmm.
you've done, what, five cookbooks and one memoir?
Six cookbooks and one memoir.
Okay. What for you, for someone for whom literature was so important, for someone who does their own writing and has a very busy personal and professional life, what drives you into the next book? Like, what makes you decide, okay, this is an idea, I'm going to saddle up again and do another book, which is a ton of work. A ton of work.
It is a ton of
cookbooks
work.
Are a ton of work. I mean, more than people realize.
I'm bemused when I hear a chef of any age say,
yeah,
I'm going to write a book. You know, I'm going to write a book. Almost like saying, you know, I'm going to go to the store.
Right.
It's like, if you've ever written one, you know, you wouldn't approach it kind of cavalierly.
No.
It's rarely ever anything that's going to make anybody be able to go out and buy a new Mustang next week or something
like that.
Yeah. I fell in love with literature and with reading. As a child,
yeah,
you know, if my mother could not hear me, she would said he's reading somewhere, and then go find out where I was reading, because I always loved the stories. I was definitely if somebody said, "What do you want to be when you were 8 years old?" I would look at them and say, "I want to be a writer, an artist, a poet, something like that."
Yeah.
And they would be like, "That's crazy! You can't, you know, count on that. You can't, you know." They really wanted me to be more realistic about that.
Yeah, sure.
But loving writing was central to my own life. And so I wanted to do it, but I think that I felt like I didn't know if I could handle that journey of potential rejection. And I fell into cooking quite by accident.
Yeah.
And suddenly I was good at something and I was being paid to be doing it, not much.
Yeah.
I mean, $3.25 an hour.
Yeah.
But it was different, and I loved the whole circus world of the diners and short order places that I worked at. Overnight barbecue place, the Midget in Key West. Working at a Holiday Inn in Colorado underneath a Navy cook that taught me his soups while he recovered from a mishap from falling down a flight of stairs drunk. All those kind of adventures were...
the stories kind of got in my mind and stayed there until I did write my memoir,
yeah,
where they came to breathe again. But there was certainly a long period of time where I had to put writing on a back burner, because to learn to cook, to be the chef, to become the chef and be the chef, was a much more manic life than a writer's normal life.
Sure. But like, so sitting here right now with 7 books to your name, is there another, you don't have to say what it is, is there already another idea percolating in your head? Do you think, do you assume you will at some point write another book or more?
I think I will, and I think it'll probably be a couple more years, because writing the most recent book was a big task, and you know what that's like. But, you know, as the person who coined the term fusion cuisine, there is a book in me that has to do with writing a book on fusion cuisine.
Oh, that's interesting.
So I think of that as the big book. You know, there was a book called New World Cuisine that I wrote back, and Jason Epstein was my editor from Random House.
Yeah.
And we sometimes still call that the big book. And that was a book that was me seeking to explain the fusion between old world cooking and new world cooking, specifically these hyphenations between French cooking and Asian cooking and Caribbean cooking.
Yeah.
And it was the beginning of the 90s when I wrote that book.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, I think for me to do a book on fusion cuisine will be the next book I at least imagine doing.
Uh-huh.
Maybe I'll do a book with our cooking school, though, too.
That's interesting. We're going to talk about that after the break.
Yeah.
I do want to, though, ask, how long was it from inception to publication of your memoir, No Experience Necessary?
Well, I was asked to write, you know, contribute for those Don't Try This at Home.
The thing that I worked on.
Yeah, the thing you worked on. And that was definitely a Kickstarter. It made me think about starting
it. Is that right?
I
didn't realize that was that direct.
Yeah.
For people who don't know, Don't Try This at Home was a collection of 40 kitchen disaster stories, co-edited by myself and an agent named Kim Witherspoon in New York City. And I told this story when we were together last night, Norman, when I called Norman to offer my services to help interview you and ghostwrite the story. You said, I think maybe I'll take a crack at it.
I remember it in another way, too.
That was where this started for you?
Yeah.
I didn't realize that.
There was another reaction. It might have been Kim's, but they said, well, who wrote the story? And I laughed, and I said, well, what do you mean? I thought we were supposed to write them. And they said, well, I don't think more than 3 people in the book wrote the story by themselves. And I was like, oh, is it okay? And they were like, yeah, you wrote this by yourself? And I said, like, yeah. And they said, well, have you ever thought about writing a whole book?
Oh, I distinctly remember when I got your story in, saying, guys, this guy, you know, Norman can freaking write.
You know? Thank you.
Yeah. I mean, I was blown away.
So I think maybe...
I mean, the other people who wrote in that book, you know, we're talking... Tony Bourdain wrote his own story. Gabrielle Hamilton wrote his own story.
Of course.
These were people who were already sort of known as chef writers. Dan Barber wrote his own story.
Okay. I'll go back and read that
Not many. Not many. Not many.
I think it took about maybe beginning to end about 2.5-3 years.
That's not bad, given how much you have going on.
No, but I'll tell you, the dedication that it does take, or anybody that's going to write, you got to set that alarm clock.
Yeah.
Because once you get into your day, it's not probable.
So you were an early morning writer.
It's 5 o'clock, and then I would go down by myself to a writing table.
Yeah.
And write, and try and write for 4 hours.
Really? What, 5 days a week?
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah,
that's dedication. How much do you think ended up on the cutting room floor?
Half.
Yeah.
I guess.
Yeah. All right.
That's good for maybe more should have.
I think that's good for people to hear. I think that's good for people to hear. I always say it. I made a lot of my living for a number of years as a collaborator. There is nothing like a chef or anyone else who is actually able to write on their own. I think there's always something missing when it comes through the filter of a collaborator, and I think that's what makes Norman's memoir so great. We're going to take a quick break.
Yep.
And we will be right back. We are chatting with Chef Norman Van Aken at Palacio de los Jugos in... Are we technically in Coral Gables here?
Yeah, you could say so.
I think we're barely over the line in Coral Gables.
Right across the street there.
My hometown of Coral Gables, Florida. And we will be right back after this break. Like a four-leaf clover. Like the tenant bride, landing on all 4 feet like
My theme song and break music is from After School Specials album Double Barrel, Single Entendre, which is available on iTunes.
Today's program is brought to you by Whole Foods Market. From papayas and samosas to reishi mushrooms, if it's something that sounds delicious, chances are you'll find the freshest, best version of it at Whole Foods Market. They have more than 400 stores across the country, so if you consider pizza its own food group or just can't imagine when avocado toast wasn't a thing, Whole Foods Market has you covered. Visit wholefoodsmarket.com to find a store near you. Whole Foods Market, whatever makes you whole.
And we are back, and we will return you to the rest of our interview with Norman Van Aken in just a moment. But first of all, this is you've heard of an out-of-body experience. This is an out-of-show experience. This is a brief sit-down between me and Dan Kluger. Hi, Chef.
Hey, how are you?
A lot of you met Dan earlier in the season. We did an interview for the show. Dan is putting on an event connected to my book. It is a one-of-a-kind event. It was his idea. It's amazingly exciting, I think, for you all if you're based in New York or if you'll be here, and incredibly flattering for me. So just quickly to set this up, in my book, Chefs, Drugs, and Rock and Roll, there is an entire chapter which I call the Stanford Court Gang, and it is the story of what, to most people's recollection, I haven't found anyone who's corrected this, was the first large-scale, multi-chef collaborative dinner. This is the kind of thing that guys like you get roped into all the time now. But at the time, it was incredibly exciting. It was put on by the American Institute of Wine and Food. Michael McCarty, who still has Michael's restaurant in Santa Monica, and Michael's in New York. It was his brainchild. Jonathan Waxman kind of assembled the chefs. And it was, in hindsight, an amazing group of people, many of whom were meeting each other for the first time. So the chefs who participated were Jeremiah Tower, Jonathan Waxman, Mark Miller, Alice Waters, Larry Forgione, who at the time was in New York at an American place, Paul Prudhomme from New Orleans, Brad Ogden and Jimmy Schmidt from the Midwest. And the pizzas for the after party were cooked and presented by a team from Spago, the original Spago in Los Angeles, at the after party. So Dan reached out to me and said, hey, I have this idea. I want to do a dinner where I being Dan, riff on the dishes that were served at the original Stanford Court dinner. And that tribute dinner is happening just before the 35th anniversary of the original dinner. That will be May 3rd. The actual dinner at Loring Place is on April 23rd. That's a Monday night. That's at 6:30 p.m. And Dan, why don't you tell us, what's it been like for you researching these, you know, to me, these sort of Mount Rushmore type figures and doing your modern take on their food?
It's been a lot of fun. You know, going back to when I first got this menu and we started talking about this, I looked at the menu and was kind of overwhelmed with the idea of doing our riff on some of these dishes that you know, people like Paul Prudhomme, Alice Waters, et cetera, that you know, they're so embodied in our culture of chefs.
They're like part of the DNA of what you do.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so to try and do something inspired by them should be really easy, but also very nerve-wracking.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up cooking at a time when all these guys were already, you know, famous. They'd all hit their groove. Chefs were definitely much more front and center than when this dinner really first started.
Yeah.
I had started going to a lot of these chef events as a cook.
Yeah.
And started to experience what that's like to be a group of chefs, you know, cooking together, et cetera.
Yeah.
So I kind of put myself in a mode of thinking back to when I first started cooking and who were people that I looked up to. And a lot of these people were all mentioned in the book.
Uh-huh.
Alfred Portal, obviously Jonathan Waxman, Jeremiah Tower, And then Charlie Trotter was one that was really important to me because pretty much every night after cooking at Union Square Cafe, I'd go home and I'd look at my copy of the latest Charlie Trotter book.
And
once I learned all those techniques, I moved on to the next one. And then I bought Alfred's book. And then I bought Charlie Palmer's book, who's also in this. So I started going back to all these old books that I had, Michelle Richard, et cetera. And I started pulling things out that coincided with these dishes in some form or another, but spoke a little bit more to how I like to cook.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've really done what I think is a fun rendition of food of that period, which is really its own thing.
Yeah.
But doing our riff using some chilies, using acid, using some Indian spices, and just trying to pull it all together as one contiguous dinner.
Yes.
Whereas before, I'm sure it was amazing, but I think each chef did his own thing.
Yes.
And it was less thought of in terms of how is this course going to follow the next course, et cetera. And so
we've
kind of built this out in terms of...
You smoothed it out.
I think so.
Yeah.
So it's been a lot of fun. And, you know, we've already done a lot of recipe testing, and everybody who's seen things and tasted things is really excited for the dinner.
Yeah, it was funny. I was waiting the last time you and I had a meeting about it a couple weeks ago. Is it Diane? Anna, your pastry chef, who used to be at Elan, working for my buddy David Waltok, and I didn't realize she was your pastry chef. And she came over and she said, "Oh, we've been thinking about the dessert," and she seemed all excited about it.
Very excited. She gave me something I think that day that is phenomenal.
Yeah,
and it's you know, again, the inspiration behind, you know, taking something that was Jeremiah Towers that was obviously very specific to that time.
Yes.
And using these ingredients, but trying to really flip it on its head and do something maybe a little modern or have a different punch of flavor, et cetera. And I think this one is really cool.
That's great. So this is, it's about an 8-course meal.
8 courses.
The original dinner was the American Institute of Wine and Food. All the wine served at the dinner. Again, this was 1983. Yep. This was revolutionary too. It was all American wines. You are pairing wines with this dinner.
Yeah, so Natalie Johnson, our somm, is really looking for all American wines to be used throughout the dinner.
Yeah.
To, you know, mimic again what was used back then. And
yes.
Even looking for some older vintages and things like that.
Yes. We are still, as we sit here today, figuring out exactly where the link will live, because we're recording this about a week before this episode will drop. But there will be something in some fashion on the Loring Place homepage that will direct you to a reservations page. There will be something on my blog, Tokeland, on the appearances page, tokeland.com/appearances. And if you scroll down to April 23rd, the appearances are listed chronologically. You will see a description and you will see a link. You have a limited number of seats for this. This is in your private dining room, which is how it takes about 40 people.
Yep, about 40 people.
I should also say that we've extended invitations to the original participants, obviously with the exception of the late Paul Prudhomme, who's no longer with us, but Michael McCarty, whose brainchild this event was. Michael was a real cheerleader for what was happening across the country in the early 80s. Michael McCarty and his wife Kim will be in attendance. And in addition to you and me making some remarks, Michael's going to make some remarks, and I'm going to put him on the spot. Jonathan Waxman, you got RSVP, dude. We're hoping you'll be there too, since you were such a part of it, although you may not be in town that week. So that's it. We hope you can join us. We think it's going to be a really special night. And in addition, along with the wine and the food, everybody gets a copy of the book, which I will be personalizing. And I just don't know if you're interested in food, food history, modern food. It's like the whole package.
Yep.
Time Machine Dinner.
It's a great book.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And thanks for doing this dinner. And thank all of you for listening. And we will now return you to our interview with the great Norman Van Aken, recorded at Palacio de los Jugos in my hometown of Miami a few weeks back. Let's get back to that. So, Norman, tell me about these two new things you have going down in the Miami area.
Mm-hmm.
I experienced, well, as much as I could, one of them, and more fully the other one. Mm-hmm. Let's first talk about the new restaurant you have down
there,
or new-ish. It opened in the fall.
Yeah, late October.
Okay. And it's called?
It's called Three. And it's spelled out.
Yeah.
Well, I joke because we couldn't make up our minds. That's one of the reasons. And there's three of us.
Uh-huh.
But there's also the three endeavors that are there. They're in a connected space called the Wynwood Arcade in the Wynwood Arts District of Miami.
Yeah.
There's a building there that's, I don't know what it was in its former lives, but we have the restaurant Three. which is a what I would call a semi, not formal restaurant, but high-end restaurant that is open 6 nights a week.
Yeah.
And then there's the cooking school, which is adjacent to the restaurant.
Yeah.
Which will be open soon, and we'll come back to that.
Yeah.
And then upstairs on the roof, there is a lounge called Number 3 Social. So there's the three people, there's the three endeavors, and we also were, you know, thinking about the mystical number three and what it means to the universe and some religions and all
of
that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So the three things.
So the restaurant, I have to say, I came, now I grew up in Miami. I think I may, I can't, I've been running around so much, I can't remember who I said what to anymore, which is a frightening feeling. But I think I may have said it to you. When I did. When I grew up in Florida in the 70s and 80s, early 80s, Florida, Miami area was past its prime. I always say it was sort of coasting on the fumes of the 50s, you know, the Fountain Blue Hotel and the glory days of all that. There was a steakhouse called The Forge on Miami Beach.
Still
there.
Still there.
There was Christie's where you went for prime rib and Caesar salad in the Gables. Still there. There was nothing that you would really call like a hot hip, you know, the scene, the South Beach scene was right after I kind of split. The downtown scene right now, where your restaurant is, where your cooking school is, I would liken it to the Miami equivalent of Williamsburg in Brooklyn. I would liken it to the what's going on in Venice Beach area of the greater Los Angeles area. That's what it feels like over there. It's very, it's a high energy. There's art in the streets. There's art on the buildings. And there's a huge energy. It's very young in a lot of ways. And your restaurant there, I mean, to me, as someone who grew up here, when I walked in there yesterday, the design just knocked me out. It's very, in a smart way, and not in a kitschy, corny, tropical way. It's a very colorful dining room. You've got a beautiful open kitchen.
Yeah, it is.
A nice little, not a huge bar. It's not a, well, you have the upstairs, but the bar in the restaurant, there's what, maybe 8 seats at that bar?
Maybe 6.
6 or 8?
Yeah.
I had a little bite there, but it's not meant to have a raucous bar scene. This is a grown-up restaurant.
Right.
But this is Miami. You don't have to put on even, I was the only person maybe in a sport coat last night.
Right.
People were dressed very smart. People look, it's a good-looking crowd. The food was so great.
Well, thank you.
The food just knocked me out. I had the chowder.
Yes,
was it hamachi collar?
Yes.
Yes. From I didn't realize when I ordered it, but it comes with a side order or a side dish of corn tortillas.
Tortillas, yeah.
And you make, there's an, what's the name of that avocado condiment?
Oh, guascasa?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is like a creamier guacamole almost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
American. There was an herb salad with Fresno chili sliced up in it. There was a half a lime. And you cut pieces of the hamachi collar, and you put the condiment on and the herb salad, and you ate it like a soft taco. Mm-hmm.
And the herbs were brought in from our farmer friends just in the Redlands down south, and their tortillas are made by a local guy named Steve Santana. And the hamachi collar is just a great way to, you know, get more into the nose-to-tail cooking of the fish.
Yeah.
And people love it. I'm so surprised to see how popular that has been. But coming back for a moment to the design and to the restaurant, this is, you know, this is a partnership with Candace Walsh and Susan Buckley. And Candace and I met like 3 years ago as I first sought to realize my dream of doing a cooking school.
Yeah.
We had not known each other. We were introduced through a business friend. Susan has a long history, especially in, New York and California with the Standard Hotel Groups as being the vice president in charge of food and beverage. So their powerhouse is Candace has all kinds of financial experience, and her design eye is incredible. We traveled together. She has a home in Bordeaux, and so we went to her home there, and we dined around in France, and then we went to Paris, and we dined around in Paris, and then we went to New York, and we dined in New York, and just the things that she was attracted to were really more elevated than the sense of, you know, beyond the scope of what a lot of people think about as being a cool restaurant or something.
Yeah.
Much more chic, much more secure in its own savoir-faire.
Yeah, that's a good word for it.
You know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
One of the only French words you'll hear me say today, maybe.
The other,
except Chevrolet.
The other thing that really struck me is, and I did not realize this until I don't know what his official title is. Jeffrey Brana, General manager?
Jeffrey is general manager
of the
school.
But he's also been a chef.
Oh, he's an accomplished chef. He came to work with me from Tampa as a kid.
Yeah.
20 years old. And, you know, one that I didn't know who he was for a little while. He was in the back trying to lay low and not get cut and burned and learn the trade. Like Charlie Trotter many, many years before when he started with me. But Jeffrey, you know, dedicated and professional and another reader, really. But he, you know, he's wearing more than one hat right now. He's not only the general manager of the school, but he's also sort of pro tem, beyond chef de cuisine, something, I don't know, vice chancellor, we'll say, of the restaurant.
But I didn't realize this, and what was so striking to me, that hamachi dish is a relatively new dish, yeah?
For us?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. The chowder, though, is from the Norman Van Aken Hall of Fame.
This is a
version of a dish you've been serving for decades.
I learned a version of the dish from James Beard's work. Billy B, named for Lucius Beebe. Mr. Beard did one with mussels and cream, and I just took a cue from that, but used coconut milk and saffron and star anise. I started making that in the Keys, and it continues to this day to be my most well-loved soup, I'm sure.
But what was amazing to me was how well that dish and this new dish got along, and how of the moment, I say this about Jonathan Waxman all the time, I think the real visionaries are the ones whose stuff still works today. You know, Jonathan's food hasn't changed all that much. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing to me that you...
Not.
No, but it's amazing to me that something that's on your current menu, can coexist with something that has that much history behind it. And then I have to just say, and I'm not remembering her name, but the dessert that I had was a, if I'm getting this right, torta de crema catalana.
Yeah.
Which was basically sliced like a piece of pie,
mm-hmm.
crema catalana on a pastry base, mm-hmm. like a shell,
mm-hmm.
and then the top was brûléed.
Yes.
That dessert was freaking amazing.
She is sensational. Mame comes from Senegal in Africa.
Yeah.
Where her family and she lived until about, I think, the age of 11 before migrating to the United States. And she brings another element. I mean, for many, many years, you know, we've talked about my cuisine, New World cuisine, you know, deriving its inspiration from Latin America, the Caribbean, with touches of Asia and Africa. But in many ways, the African influences of the cuisine were a little bit more derived from people who had, you know, been through the diaspora for generations.
Right. Yeah.
Rather than someone actually born in Africa and coming and bringing that sensibility and sensitivity to the menu creations that we're doing right now. And I'm delighted that she's with us because I just find it another and very refreshing opportunity. The chef de cuisine, born and raised in Miami, of Cuban descent, and his name is Miguel Massens.
Yeah, great guy.
And he worked with Thomas Keller at the French Laundry for a long time, and he worked with Daniel Boulou in New York, both at the front of the house and the back of the house. So he wanted to return home to Miami and see what he could show the world about what one could do with the flavors of Miami. And I said, young man, you've come to the right place, you know. Even though I am a Midwestern gringo by birth, I was chosen to cook with Jose Andres, Aaron Sanchez, and Gaston Acurio in Los Angeles for this Masters of Latin Cuisine two years ago. And they all jokingly thought it was just...
You're an honorary member.
I was, yes. Yeah. They said I would need to learn to speak fluent Spanish that evening, which I didn't.
I'm going to guess that being asked to do something like that for you with that group is probably as meaningful as any sort of inclusion you've ever been privy to in your very distinguished career.
No doubt about it. I mean, there was a moment where they did an interview with, particularly with Jose and Aaron, there's a great little video snip, a Vine kind of a thing, where we're all looking over at a massive screen.
Yeah.
And they're speaking about, you know, the way I affected them in terms of Latin cuisine.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that, yes, that is a huge...
That's amazing.
...compliment. Something I almost feel like, you know, that's not possible. But they said so. So I hope it's possible.
Well, because you came to it without the... Burden's the wrong word, but
it
without...
It is kind of a right word.
But without
obligation.
The... Yeah, without the, what's the legal word, encumberment of growing up with that stuff.
No, I didn't. I wasn't going to make a grandma unhappy because I was doing something Nicaraguan versus Argentine.
Right, exactly.
I came as an acolyte to this place and fell in love with it, and but it was unobstructed by any allegiances that might have said that this doesn't belong within this country.
Right.
For me, there was no country line, no demarcation that was an outlaw to me. My only rule was flavor.
Yeah.
That was the sheriff in my town.
I have a question to you, and this will lead us into talking about the school, I think. It seems to me, Norman, that you are very much... Thank you, Janet. Janet just saved me. I almost just dumped a Coca-Cola all over myself.
It's the real thing.
It's the real thing. It seems to me that you very much respond to, like, having in your midst, like, working with, like, collaborating with people who, by the calendar, are significantly younger than you. It seems to me like you derive your eyes are... sparkling as I ask this question. It seems to me like you derive a ton of energy from not just the scene where you find yourself with your new enterprises down here, but from your team.
Absolutely. Oh, I love it.
This does not, to put it in rock and roll terms, right? This restaurant, from somebody, you wouldn't call yourself this, but from someone who's an icon down here, where someone's been at the game in Florida for as long as you have, to put it in rock and roll terms, the restaurant does not feel like a nostalgia tour. It feels like a concert. Okay?
Yeah.
Right? But that has to be in part due to what you get from putting yourself smack dab in the, there's this hot place, Salty Donut, is in the same complex where you are.
Right.
It's like this red hot business. You've put yourself in the midst of a group of people who are super young and bring this energy to it. And I have to think that feeds you in some respect. And I'll let you segue into the cooking school from that.
Yeah. Andrew, this thing about cooking is like, it's a great craft. It's a great artistic field to be in, because I think that I can cook now as well, if not better, than I've ever cooked before. I am impressed, to say the least, when I see artists who were in their 60s and 70s and 80s, you know, which I'm still a ways from that.
Yes.
But do work that is equitable with the work they were doing much younger. I think I was smiling a lot because I thought about Tony Bennett doing collaborative things with like Lady Gaga and things like that.
Fascinating.
What it would have been like for each side of the divide.
Yeah.
I mean, I have had, I don't know how many, I mean, like Jonathan Waxman and other people that are in your book, hundreds if not thousands of people who have come through the school of Norman Van Aken in our kitchens, and who to this day know they can call me up, ask for advice, get the in nuance of a term, ask for a place to go if they're traveling in another country, because that is the family tree.
Yes.
That is our family tree,
yeah.
And I get to be, I don't know, I guess I'm at the roots of the family tree, but I can look at the leaves as they are emerging and seeing what they're doing, and it's something that gives me great, it gives me a fatherly pride, and I'm proud of our son for doing what he's doing, and I'm proud of the young men and women that are doing what they're doing, and I want them to have a bit easier time down the road, if at all I can help in that way.
That's great. So with that in mind, you've started almost, because it is not yet open as we sit here today, although we did do an event there last night.
Right.
Thank you very much. You hosted me for a mutual book event, your memoir and my book. You have this cooking school in the kitchen with Norman Van Aken. It is not a full-time cooking program.
Not for a degree or anything like that.
Right. But so what is it? Tell people what it is.
Well, I think it's, time that people had a chance to learn more how to cook. So our school is for that. It's for anyone who wants to learn how to cook. And there'll be many different levels of that, from basic raw beginner to a person who could be quite proficient as a cook but would like to do more. Maybe they're very good at, let's say, Mediterranean cooking, but they don't know anything about Japanese cooking.
Yes.
All of those things they'll be able to do. There'll be classes for children. There'll be classes for couples. There'll be corporate events. It fits, when people are cooking, it fits 16 people.
Yeah.
There'll be our website, which they'll be able to go on, and you make The only commitment you have to make is for a single class. You don't have to sign up for a semester. You don't have to have taken a class to understand how to take another class.
Right.
It's like joining a gym or going to a salon. There's just a list of different things. And go, wow, I'd love to learn more how to do that. And I'm, you know, unfortunately, in our cultures, the oral traditions, the ancestral traditions have been almost decimated by the modern life. You know,
yeah.
People aren't learning from their grandmothers or their mothers
right.
or their grandfathers
yeah.
or fathers. I was fortunate that I did get to learn from my mother and my grandmother. My wife, Janet, also learned at the elbow of her mother, standing
yeah.
on the apple crate and standing next to her mom stirring on the stove with the other
yeah.
seven children, not getting quite as close to the stove as somehow little Janet got her muscled into doing. But so we did grow up with that, and our son grew up with it, and our granddaughter is getting to grow up with it. But so many guests go, oh my God, you're kidding. You're going to have a cooking school
yeah.
and it's right next door and I
yeah.
can go to the cooking school.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it feels like it's really going to make people happy.
Yeah. It's great. I have to say the facility's beautiful. Norman is so eager to get open that I was opening the drawers at the individual stations where students will be for these one-off classes, and they're all fully stocked. The stuff's completely immaculately organized. The spoons are all nestled within each other. The bowls are all stacked. I mean, to the naked eye, it looks like it's ready to go. There must be some stuff behind the scenes or in the walls or in the whatever that's just not 100% there. But you guys are close.
We are so close that you could almost book a class next week and we'll be ready for you by the time you get here.
Awesome. Awesome. I love it. I love it. And I love that you still, want to do something like that.
Oh, my God. And we have the other restaurants in Central Florida, the Ritz-Carlton
yeah.
In Orlando, going strong 15 years with our team there. I'm so proud of them. They just knock it out. And then our newish restaurant in Mount Dora,
yeah.
1921 by Norman Van Aken.
Tell us quickly what that is.
That is a restaurant that we opened up a year and a half ago
yeah.
in the town of Mount Dora, a small town. Some people say it's kind of like a perfect Mayberry-like town. It's in conjunction with the Modernism Museum, which is directly across the street. That building was built in 1921, hence
yeah.
the name, and the numbers that have been on the wall since 1921 on the exterior. And we do modern Florida cuisine there. I think that what our team there is able to articulate is as good as you would find anywhere. It reminds me of Blue Hill or something.
Yeah.
Not quite as all that, but we don't have quite the gardens. But
right.
it's surprising to find something of that quality in a town that's so small.
Yeah.
The museum just bought the majority of David Bowie's art collection.
Yeah.
So that's a surprising thing
to find,
too. We've already done a James Beard dinner with the 1921 team. So it's exciting for me and Janet to go between Norman's at Orlando, Norman's in Mount, 1921 in Mount Dora. And, of course, now here we are in Miami doing the three ring circus at three.
Amazing. Amazing. Well, Norman, you know, we talked about this last night at this talk. At a time when people from around the country, I think, were flocking to where the press was, where the bigger crowds were, to the Bay Area, to New York, to L.A., you kind of, you followed your star down here, and you planted yourself here, and you stayed with it, and it's amazing to see you still doing so much here. And
I feel fortunate.
And having come from here, I can just say, you're a part of the culture of this region.
I am beginning to feel a little like the grand old man of Florida. That's
no,
true.
No.
of Florida cooking, I should say.
Wow. You still seem incredibly youthful to me.
That's okay. It's
in every way.
Right.
In every way. Thank you for making time for me. Thank you for all the support for
welcome
my book.
Home, Andrew.
Thank you very much.
You'll always
You've made
have
me
a home
very
here.
Welcome. Thank you. We'll see you again soon.
Absolutely.
And that's our show. I, of course, would like to thank Norman Van Aken for not just being on the show, but for hosting me a few weeks ago. It was an incredible, incredible time with someone I've just come to adore. I don't mind saying that on the airwaves. Norman, you're just the best. You're a good dude. And Janet, you're awesome too. I want to thank everyone I mentioned at the top of the show for the incredible hospitality people have shown me out west this week. It has just been amazing. I want to remind everybody to please follow the show. At Chef Podcast is the handle, and you can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. I'd also, as everybody knows, Melanie, you came and said hello to me the other night and said you had to write a review when we met at the event in Larkspur. Please, everybody, leave me a review or a rating. I really do appreciate it. And just a programming note, the season on Heritage, the season we're currently in, officially ends this week with this episode. I'm not 100% sure what I'm going to do, to be completely honest. My time has been just maxed out. I've made commitments both here and elsewhere that I haven't quite been able to keep because of the schedule. So I will just say that I have several great episodes banked. I may get some of those on the air during what is technically the gap between seasons. But failing that, they will air at the beginning of the season. I'm going to basically get them up on air as soon as I'm able to. David has graciously offered to splice them together for me as I'm able to get the intros recorded and get those ready. So a lot of great people coming your way in the next couple of weeks. David Tatasciore, thank you, as always, for engineering this thing. Caitlin Friedman, thank you not for co-hosting this week, but for holding down our very complicated fort back in Westchester, New York, while I've been on the road and letting me do this. I love you and I appreciate that. And all of you for listening, thank you. And thanks for enduring my low, hushed voice this week. I hope you enjoyed the show, and I'll see you back here soon on Andrew Talks to Chefs.